Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, are you aligned with the pre-Christian Socrates or the post-Christian Foucault? Ken, I'm not even sure a lot of us know what you mean by that, other than some interesting names, but I know this is going to be a fascinating podcast. And if you didn't hear the previous one, please listen to that one as a precursor to where we're headed today.
That's right, Joe. We're going to talk a little bit about postmodernism. In our previous show, we kind of talked about premodernism, modernism, postmodernism, how these kind of philosophical eras were reactions against the previous one. And we introduced the idea that, the pagans were pre-Christian, but most of the people now are post-Christian. Christianity's been tried and rejected. And according to Lewis, that's a much more difficult nut to crack, if you will. And I mentioned, deconversions, people who have tried Christianity or said they have tried and given it up, it's harder to go back to them. But I'm going to give you a little discussion. I'm going to reach back into history and revive Socrates, the great philosopher. And I'm going to compare him with a leading secular thinker of the 20th century, Michel Foucault. And we'll talk a little bit about who they are and why they're important.
Terrific. One of the things I enjoyed from the last podcast is kind of demarcations of where we've been. I didn't know until you mentioned it that the pre-modern period, approximate dates, 500 BC to 500 AD, but that helps me to kind of get a historical view of it. And then you talked about the modern period going through scientific era of the Enlightenment and so on, and now moving into postmodernism. So I appreciate the kind of the historical timeline. I don't know if you want to say anything more on that, but it was helpful for me.
I'm glad to hear that, Joe. Many philosophers today are more analytical philosophers. I'll reference my friend Mark Perez. He's an analytic philosopher, and I'm more of a historical philosopher in the sense that the analytic philosophers, they use logic to kind of analyze various topics. I was kind of taught to appreciate the philosophical historical unfolding of things, and I might also say, when Mark and I have had lunch together, we've agreed that I'd like to hear more about the individual philosophers and their lives, not just an analysis of their metaphysics or their epistemology, but who were they and what time period did they live? And so part of that, I think, is my love for history, but also because some of my philosophy teachers taught me that way, that I'm to understand philosophy as it moves through the history of human beings. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to take you back in time a little bit here. I'm going to take you back to the pre-modern period. In fact, I'm going to take you back to prior to Christianity. I'm going to introduce you to Socrates. And Socrates, of course, was the hero of Plato. And then Plato taught Aristotle, and then Aristotle started his own university and influenced the world. But Socrates got into trouble. He was a Greek thinker. He got into trouble in Athens. He lived about 400 or 500 years before the birth of Christ. That's kind of his time period. And many people kind of look at Socrates as maybe not the first philosopher, because there are people we call pre-Socratics, Anaximander, Thales. There's this whole group of individuals we call pre-Socratic, and So they were kind of early philosophers. And then, of course, you could even go to the scriptures. I mean, you know, somebody like Solomon has a very philosophical orientation. And then you've got Confucius, you've got Siddhartha Gautama. So you have a lot of these people. But Socrates gets into real trouble because he is picky about truth. And the democracy that that Athens had at the time, they accuse him of corrupting the youth, of teaching things that were false, and they accused him of atheism. Of course, at that time, they were talking about the gods on Mount Olympus. Now, Socrates doesn't deny God. In fact, you know, I would tell you, I think, and more importantly, there have been a number of very good philosophers who have thought this as well, and that is, I think Plato was a theist. I think Plato was a theist. I think the things that Plato says about the form of the good have a very strong connection to the way Jews and Christians think about the nature of God. So what Socrates really believed, we'll kind of never know, but he was arrested and he was put on trial. And of course, the story is that he drank the hemlock because he you know, was confronted by all of this. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Socrates and his ideas, because he has a confrontation with a group of people that were called the Sophists. And of course, that's where we get that word sophistry, right? Where you use language to kind of manipulate people. It's kind of a use of propaganda, if you will. Well, Socrates, I think, was a remarkable individual. What were his views of truth? Well, he believed that truth was objective. He believed that it was outside of himself. That there was a basis for truth, and he believed that it could be discovered through reason, through experience. He also believed that truth was absolute, that is, it was set, it was determined, it was true for all people at all times everywhere. He believed that truth was knowable and discoverable. Again, you had to work hard at it. He developed the Socratic dialogue, where he would kind of interrogate you. And, you know, I would think it probably wouldn't be a very pleasant thing to have Socrates interrogate you. But we have this Socratic method of teaching. Joe, even in the catechisms of the Reformation, you have this question and answer kind of format. That's Socratic. You know, where you ask a penetrating question, and then you come up with formidable answers to it. So he believed that truth was knowable, that it was discoverable. And I think you could also argue that he believed that truth corresponded to reality. What we mean by that, we call that the correspondence theory of truth. So if I have an idea, and that idea matches or corresponds with the way reality is, or the way the world really is, then I know the truth. So that's kind of the correspondence theory of truth. And he thought that truth was the object of your life. You were put here not to just enjoy your life and engage in the pursuit of pleasure. He believed that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so he's kind of the quintessential philosopher, that life is about asking the deep questions. Life is about pursuing the truth. And he believed that's what we were made to do. And in fact, I think we could extend that to Plato. I mean, when you read some of Plato's early writings, and the early writings of Plato are Socratic dialogues. So what Plato did is he took real life examples from Socrates, and then maybe sometimes he might have even colored it up a little bit. Who knows? Socrates is kind of the mouthpiece for Plato, if you will. So scholars have asked, well, is that a Platonic idea or is that a Socratic idea? So we're never quite sure, but I think it's very much the case that Socrates and then Plato and then Aristotle and that whole school, they believed that truth was real, that it was discoverable, and that human beings had a purpose in life, and that was to live a fulfilled life, to live a reflective life. You're not here just to have fun. You're not here just to be entertained. You're here to grow as a human being. And so that's probably Socrates' most famous line, the unexamined life is not worth living. And it, and if you think of the idea of, logos, ethos, and pathos, logos, that's where we get our word logic, your abilities there, logos should take you to truth. And, ethos, that's kind of your moral categories, that should take you to goodness. And your pathos, that is your feeling, that should lead you to the beautiful. And so for Socrates and for Plato and Aristotle, there was a plan and a purpose. Human beings were here for a purpose. And so there was truth, there is meaning, there's purpose and their value. And they grounded them in the gods. They grounded them in, the broad picture. Plato talked about the world of forms and the form of the good. And I actually think that you could make a pretty good case that Plato was some kind of theist. I mean, some people have even said, did Plato pick up the Bible? I don't think there's any evidence that he did. But he doesn't have to, because the Bible says everybody's made in the image of God. Everybody has general revelation. Everybody has common grace. The pagans, and Augustine said the Platonists were at the head of the line. They were well known for their integrity and for their thoughtfulness, even though Augustine said they're still a long ways away. I'm not surprised that Plato and Aristotle got certain things right. And by the way, I think what's interesting now is that in the early church, there was this clash of what is Christianity's position to this Greco-Roman world with these giant thinkers like Plato and Aristotle and Stoicism and all of that. But today, when we talk about worldviews, when we talk about naturalism and postmodernism and skepticism, in many ways, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, they're seen as allies to Christianity. Mm. In classical Christian education, and by the way, I discovered just this week that the number of parents homeschooling in the state of California has tripled. And lots of people are looking to educate their kids, not in a public school, but in maybe a classical charter school. And with classical thinking, they're going to introduce you to Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Then they'll introduce Augustine and Anselm and Aquinas, etc. So this is Socrates. Now, he has the people he spars with. He's got people who are very suspicious of him, and they're called the Sophists. There's a group of individuals that kind of fit into the category of the Sophists. Now, to give you a little contrast, Socrates, of course, says truth is objective. It's real. It's outside of you. It's something you discover. You don't invent it. It's out there, and you have to go after it. The Sophists said, no, truth is subjective. Truth is it comes from you. Truth is not absolute, like Socrates says, it's relative, which means it's changing. It might change from person to person. They also say you can't know that much of it. It's equivocal, and they say that truth isn't so much discoverable as it's invented. It's conventional. People kind of get together and we kind of vote. And well, you think that's immoral? Okay, well, you know, the majority of us think that's wrong, so we'll make that wrong. We'll act as if that's wrong. Also, the sophists thought that truth didn't correspond to reality. They said that truth was that which is practically useful or workable. Now, I want to make a point there. It has been said that the ancient Jews, they sought knowledge in order to reverence God. You know, you look in the Old Testament, you look at the wisdom literature, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So anything you learn in life has relevance to your relationship with God. That moves on. And the Greeks, of course, they argue, no, that you gain knowledge so you can be rational. I think it's true in the modern world that we gain knowledge so that we can use it. So, Dave, there's a lot of pragmatism that moves from the modernist period to the postmodernist period. What's workable? What's useful? Dave, I think you see some of that when I first came to RTB and I first got to meet some of the scientists, and I would ask them, well, why does science work? They would often kind of look at me in a puzzling way and say, it just works. And I think that in science moving away from its origins and its worldview connections, its philosophical connections to Christianity, I think that science has taken on this kind of very pragmatic, very kind of workable. It solves problems. That's kind of the element. So Socrates, a correspondence view, if your idea matches reality, then you have the truth. The sophists would say, no, that which is workable, that which is useful, that which solves the problems in life, that's what you should search for. And here's what the sophists said. They said that truth is not as important as power. Even in those days, they said, look, you know, we can have these philosophical, these epistemological, metaphysical discussions and act like we're kind of working through this. But in reality, push comes to shove. How many votes do you have? How much money do you have? What kind of influence do you have? Now, what I hope our listeners will appreciate is this. You got a good slice of postmodernism all the way back prior to Christianity. It's not like these ideas are in any way brand new. Many of the things we're experiencing today, that you could see them even in the days of Socrates. Wow. And so they go back a very, very long way. And so in a couple of my books, in A World of Difference, and even in my latest book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I have these kind of charts where you see, you know, the differing perspectives that are being set forth. Now, but let me stop there for a moment before we move away from Socrates and Sophists and come back to our postmodern thinking. Any questions or comments you want to make?
I'm tracking. How about you, Dave?
You know, I think we're moving in the right direction here.
Okay, let me now introduce you to a leading postmodern thinker, although he didn't like the terminology. I think philosophers sometimes don't like to be titled or to be labeled, if you will. But let me introduce Michel Foucault. His last name is spelled F-O-U-C-A-U-L-T, Foucault, the pronunciation. Michel, think of it as Michael, if you will, be the equivalent of the English Michael. He's born in 1926. He dies in 1984. Foucault is a very dense thinker. He's French. He comes from a very wealthy and well-educated background. I don't think he liked people kind of looking into his past because you know, he became a communist, and he wanted the capitalist to be overturned and the working man, but he didn't come from a working man's family. I should also tell you that he was a homosexual and that he died of AIDS in the 1980s. He lived a promiscuous life in terms of his own sexuality. Now, I don't say that to necessarily beat up on the guy. I say that in large measure to try to understand who he was and his ideas. Now, remember that as we move forward in history, away from pre-modern to modern to post-modern, the world gets a lot more suspicious, a lot more skeptical, and morality gets a lot more liberal. Maybe we don't have to have sexual relations between man and woman. Maybe same-sex relationships. Maybe we can experiment with different genders. So you can see that many of the ideas, I mean, when I was a young man, things like same-sex relationships were looked down upon. I mean, the neighborhood I came out of, which was Catholic, which was kind of a Mexican-American neighborhood in the suburb of Los Angeles. I lived in Artesia, went to Cerritos High School. For a family to be divorced, that was almost shocking. That was kind of in the early 60s, right? Well, Foucault, he addresses the relationship, particularly between power and knowledge, and how social institutions use control. So let me kind of develop this a bit for you. Foucault is really influenced by Nietzsche. He sees this idea of, you can't, God doesn't exist. Foucault's an atheist. God doesn't exist, so you can't ground morality and truth in God because he's not there. And he's critical of modernism, science, and this kind of objective rationality. That doesn't work. So he doesn't believe that there is any objective truth or values. He accepts kind of the dismantling of God as the foundation for truth and values. And he accepts Nietzsche's idea of perspectivalism. Now, let me explain what we mean by that. If God doesn't exist, then there's no objective ground for truth and meaning and morality. Therefore, you're just left with people's perspectives. Well, is that true for you? Well, it's true for me. I don't know if it's true. What's your truth? I mean, when I would watch Oprah Winfrey, she would say, you have to have a truth for you. And I hear college students speak that way. I hear Christians sometimes speak that way. That's your truth. Well, wait a second. Socrates is going to say what? Truth is objective. If there's truth, it's for all people at all times everywhere. No, with postmodernism, and we see this in Foucault, you're left with perspectivalism. Everybody has a perspective. Now, Foucault's going to throw off these ideas of truth, and he's going to say they're really just power plays. And Joe, I think this will connect with you very much. He talks a lot about language. He talks about modes of discourse. And he says that in order for people to have power and keep power, they have to use language. They have to manipulate language. And so the capitalists, they control the workers and they control the language of, they kind of hide their oppression of the oppressed peoples. And so Foucault's very close to Jacques Derrida and this idea of deconstruction. Now again, I'm going to bring you back to a principle we've been talking about for two programs. Notice how everything is dismantled. everything is becoming, there's more suspicion, there's more doubt, there's less certainty. Oh, truth, meaning, and purpose are grounded in God. No, now it's grounded in man, discovered by reason and science. No, it can't be discovered there. Maybe there really is no ultimate truth. It's all about survival and power, power plays. Now, again, I think what's interesting from a couple standpoints, and then I want to look at Socrates and compare him with Foucault. We when we look at 2020 and 2021, there was some point last year where I thought we really are living in a new era. I mean, for a long time, I have wondered whether postmodernism was just some interesting ideas that gray-haired Ivy League professors debated about, and whether it had any practical import, you know, on Main Street or in the suburbs. Well, after 2020, it's here. And I think when we see things like critical race theory, cancel culture, we see a lot of the relativism. We see that our universities, I mean, I don't know what's being taught. I mean, do we really want our elementary school kids to have the categories of race, gender, and class introduced to them? Do we want the white boys and girls to be seen as the oppressors? And the boys and girls that have dark skin, brown or black, that they are the oppressed. There's a reason why in the state of California, homeschooling and classical charter schools are becoming more popular. One individual said that California has seen the largest increase in homeschooling. So at some point of last year, I thought, no, I think postmodernism is not just something gray-haired old philosophers debate. And Joe, it comes down to this. It comes down to language. Well, how do you define marriage? Mm-hmm. How do you define sexuality? How do you define a gender? I mean, can we be blunt a little bit? I mean, we live at a time where a man who may be a tall, well-muscled individual, he may say, I want to be known as a woman. Well, we've come a long way. Now I'm going to say something I think is scary. I don't know what our listeners will think. But if you would have told me just a few years ago, before same-sex marriage became lawful throughout our country, if you would have told me that, you know, we were just a couple years away from same-sex marriage, I'd have said, nah, I don't think so. But here we are. Now the question is, what will America look like in 10 years? Now the question comes back to apologetics and evangelism. How do we reach out to people? I think C.S. Lewis was very prescient. I think he was a prophet. I think he spoke truths, and he saw the future to some degree. I think that we are living at a time that is very different than the one that we lived in the past. And again, Foucault would be that kind of individual. We need to rethink economic relationships. We need to rethink our understanding of sexuality and gender. We need to rethink our concepts of race. And some people have been quite clear that critical race theory is just Marxism, but instead of responding to class, you're responding to race. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to now go back a little bit and look at Socrates and Foucault. And again, I'm more of a historical philosopher. And one of the reasons I'm that way, and one of the reasons why I like my book, Classic Christian Thinkers, is I try to use biography to introduce you to theology and philosophy and apologetics. I like to know who was that person, right? And I don't know if I'm kind of an oddball, I might be, but whenever I'm interested in a subject, I like to know as much about it as I possibly can. So I'm not just interested in Platonism, I'm interested in Plato, and who was he, and how did he come to get his ideas, and you know, who did he influence? Well, let's kind of put Socrates and Foucault side by side. If we were to talk about the question of morality, well, I think Foucault would fit well in the category of a sophist. He would be an ethical subjectivist. He might say something like this: whatever a person thinks or feels is morally right is right. It's right for him. So if you want to marry somebody of the same sex, or if you want to take from the rich capitalists, whatever a person thinks or feels is morally right is right for him. So the rightness or the wrongness of action depends on a person's thoughts, opinions, intentions, desires. That is, morality is relative. It depends on you. It depends on how you were treated. So moral values are what? They're subjective. They're invented. They're conventional. People get together and vote and decide. They're relative. They're merely descriptive, and all we mean by that is that you just look at the way people behave. We measure them more about their consequences, so we're back to the useful, the pragmatic, and they're very particular in orientation. Now, that's ethical subjectivism. I think we find that in our day very strongly. There isn't so much right and wrong as objective. It's subjective, it's invented, it's based on human convention, it's relativistic. Now, I think if we compared Foucault in kind of the ethical subjectivism, I think Socrates would fit well with the ethical objectivism. He might say something like this: a binding moral order exists independent of human opinion or approval. You know, in my church, I attend an Anglican church, and we often, as part of our liturgy, we go through the Ten Commandments. And the priest or the minister, the pastor, will read a section of the commandment, and then the rest of the congregation will respond, you know, Lord, by your grace, I commit myself to this. But I think of the commandments. You know, if you look at the second five, don't lie, don't steal, don't have illicit sexual relations, don't envy, that there are these moral elements. So an ethical objectivist, and I think Socrates fits that pretty well, he'd say something like this: a binding moral order exists independent of human opinion and or approval. Christians, I think, believe that when God judges the world on the day of judgment, he will have this independent moral categories, whether you like it or not. And at that time, it's too late to get grace.
Change your mind. I got a question. You know, in evaluating philosophies, we like to take the viewpoint that we're evaluating what the person is saying. What, in other words, sort of an intellectual exercise here in deciding whether it's logically correct, and we want to separate it from the kind of life that they lead, the kind of morals that they have. And it's hard for me to make that separation because I can't seem to convince myself that that when a person sets aside all the absolute morality and say it's all relative, that they have an agenda. They want to justify the position they've taken on these issues. And so their philosophy is not some objective thing out of which their life then proceeds, but the philosophy is there to justify the life that they've chosen to lead. Now, I know this is, you know, you got to be careful about this, but what do you think? I mean, is this unfair to question where, I mean, you take some of these people who are great atheists today and you ask, you know, what kind of, in a sense, I'm sorry, I'm not being very clear here, but I remember in your teaching on worldview, you have a number of criteria for judging and evaluating a worldview. Yeah. And one of them is it livable?
Yeah.
And to me, livable means that you don't have broken relationships. You don't have, disease that has been brought on by your lifestyle. You don't, you know, there's a normality that comes out of the way in which you live, which, you know, others can look at and admire. But if it's not livable, then it falls apart somewhere.
I think you're lucid and coherent there. And I think I'm tracking with you pretty well, Dave. I want to say a couple things to it. I think we see that in the life of Foucault. You know, he had psychological problems early in his life, so much so that his father, who was, well-to-do, his mother was well-to-do. They were business. In fact, that they were medical. They were in the medical field, doctors. And Foucault's father wanted his son to become a doctor. But he began being very depressed. In fact, tried to commit suicide. And his father had him see one of the leading psychiatrists. And one of the things that the psychiatrist said about Foucault is that he thought part of his problems was the inner tension and angst because he was a homosexual. And some have said that Foucault intentionally went to live in parts of Europe where there was more of an acceptance of a gay lifestyle. So relating back to you, Dave, I think that I don't think any of us are capable of corresponding our life to all of these categories. I think what I'm saying is, Dave, all of us are broken. The Christian message is that all of us are crippled. If original sin is true, and I happen to believe it is, then we cannot heal ourselves. We are broken people. And we come from families that are broken. And, is homosexuality a choice? Or, you know, could there be a basis in your DNA? These are questions that come out. But, you know, Foucault lives a very broken life. He dies from AIDS. And, I remember in the 80s, there was no way really of treating AIDS. Now there are medications that you could pretty much live, an extended life. But he is an individual. He doesn't believe in objective morality. And, he lives a lifestyle that, he finds appealing. Now, I think at the same time, though, I think he lives a tortured lifestyle. I think that's the message that really needs to get out. And that is that, people who have multiple sexual partners, people who have a very progressive kind of way of morality, these are not happy people. When you get married and you commit your vows to each other and you raise your children and you live a decent life and you work hard and pay your taxes, there are benefits from that. And then if you are a Christian, you realize you got a long way to go in sanctification, and none of us are perfect, but by the Lord's grace, by the Spirit's leading, you attempt to live a life of holiness, a sober life, a life of righteousness. Now, again, none of that's going to save you. You have to be saved by the grace of God. But I think partly, Dave, that's why I come back to these biographies. If I just looked at what Foucault taught, or even just what Socrates taught, or even just what St. Augustine taught, and I didn't look at their lives, I think I'm missing something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's true. I think the fallen nature of man is always moving a person toward a position where they try to rationalize or justify a lifestyle that deep within them, I think they know isn't right. Now, at the same time, though, I think you have to take Foucault as he's a leading intellectual. He is a very brilliant man. And, you know, without the inside baseball that we get from the New Testament, you know, this guy is an atheist. And his ideas and the ideas of postmodernism. And I want to qualify something here. I'm not saying everything in postmodernism is bad. I mean, there are some Christians who would say, no, I like some of the postmodern criticisms of modernism. I think the modernists have made knowledge claims they can't justify, or the modernists are too influenced by science and technology. I think that there are ideas that we would embrace, and you know, the idea that people should be treated with dignity, that all people are made in the image of God. And I think we can say there have been oppressors and oppressed. But it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to kind of adopt the philosophy that goes into this. So if I could contrast Socrates in the ancient world, 500 years before the birth of Christ, and compare him to Foucault, who lives in the middle of the 20th century, look at the contrast. Socrates would say morality is objective, Foucault subjective. Socrates would say morality is discovered, Foucault would say it's invented. Socrates would say morality is absolute, Foucault would say it's relative. Socrates would say it's prescriptive. You have a morality that tells you how you should behave. Just like when you get your pills from the doctors at Walgreens, it's called a prescription. It doesn't say, if you feel like it, take a pill here or there. No, it tells you, take these pills. And I, of course, always joked and said, when Jacques Derrida reads the prescription, does he deconstruct the doctors? And, you know, I don't think so. I think Derrida is an objectivist when it comes to, you know, his blood pressure pills. So it's prescriptive as opposed to what? As for Foucault, it is descriptive. And I think that in the modern world, we look at what's the consequences of your act. Whereas in the ancient world, they looked at what is the nature of your act in terms of morality. So kind of pulling these things together, notice that, yeah, we are living in kind of a new time, but not totally new. You have postmodern ideas, you have relativistic and skeptical ideas moving forward. And you know, I think it's important for Christians to understand where we're going. I think in a very practical sense, there is a professor at Princeton, George, I'm trying to remember his
name. Robert George.
Robert George. He's a professor of political philosophy. I've heard him lecture. I enjoy him. I follow him on social media. He says he thinks that Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned. There is a there's a couple issues coming to the Supreme Court. He believes that one of them will, and he says it pretty strongly, and he's a very thoughtful, careful individual. He's a Roman Catholic by conviction, leader in the pro-life movement, very articulate. He thinks that Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned. Well, what does that do? If we are living in a postmodern time, let's say your parents, I mean, the three of us have children, they're all adult children now, but what if the three of us were starting over again? Dave, you care a great deal about your family. You want to protect your family from destructive tendencies. Where are you going to educate them? How important is it that the children have a connection to spirituality and the church? How do we vote? It's kind of seldom that I get to vote for somebody that I really believe in.
Right.
A lot of times I'm blocking the other guy. I'm right. Not crazy about the person I get, but the other guy's wicked. And so I'm trying to block them. And, you know, I think I said to two of you guys, I'd like to actually vote for somebody I really believe in, somebody that I'll go work for you. You know, I like what you stand for. I believe in you. But in the history of politics, how often do you get that opportunity?
I've started giving some lessons to my grandkids on worldview. What is a worldview and what constitutes a worldview? As kind of worldview thinking as a tool for them to evaluate what they see in movies or hear from teachers and it's not easy because it's not an easy subject, but
yeah.
I'm hoping to expose them to the whole idea of worldview thinking.
I think that that's a marvelous approach, Dave. You and I, we've talked many times that worldview gives you a chance to kind of put your ideas on one side, but then to vision, well, what would the postmodernists say? What would the naturalists say? What would the Muslims say? What would the Hindus say? And you have these kind of categories. I like that. I mean, I wrote a book on the topic, and it's probably the longest book I've written. I think it's over 300 pages. But I think it has so much value in our ability to kind of compare and contrast these ideas. And I think as soon as they can be taught to young people, they should be taught. You know, and it gives us an opportunity to have a discussion with somebody where we can say, hey, what do we have in common? Now, where do we differ? And how important are those kind of differences? So I like that. But see, I like charts. I like, I like tables in my book. And some of my editor friends at RTB, they, Ken's got too many tables and that kind of stuff. But that's the educator in me.
I
love to look at something and say, how can I remember that? How can it be useful for me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's now kind of return to these three broad areas. Again, pre-modern, modern, postmodern. Obviously, in the pre-modern world, the supernatural is going to be very important. Where did the world come? God created it. God is a infinite, eternal, tri-personal, spiritual being. Supernaturalism kind of bleeds all over pre-modernism. And even if you're not Christian, you're going to believe that the gods on Mount Olympus. You're going to have things like miracles. You're going to open the New Testament and realize that if Jesus is God, we should expect that he's going to do these miracles. But modernism, it's very naturalistic. You got the natural world. Now, the natural world is a good world, and we're part of that world. We're part of nature. And, you know, I've always wondered that from an atheist point of view to a Christian point of view, how much are humans part of nature? I mean, we are part of the created realm, but I think by the image of God, we're exceptional creatures. But modernism, you have lots of naturalism, right? It's the natural world. But then in postmodernism, it's a little different in the sense that there's a lot of skepticism about what you can know. In pre-modernism, you have faith. You might even have some mysticism. In the modern world, reason dominates. It's your senses. But in the postmodern world, it's skepticism. Postmodernists, Dave, they're very suspicious about these big worldview ideas you talk about.
Right.
These big meta-narratives, you know, they're very suspicious about. They care a lot about pragmatism and practical. My dad was that way. He was a very practical person, a very pragmatic person. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, when your car breaks down, it's nice to be able to, you know, put the battery in or, you know, do something of that nature. How about human nature? And Dave, you mentioned worldviews. I've been thinking a little bit about a future book where I would look at what do these worldviews say specifically about human beings, kind of an anthropology. What do all the worldviews say about human beings or humankind? Well, in pre-modernism, particularly in Christianity, human beings are born in sin. I mean, Plato and Aristotle didn't know that. I think they knew it, but I don't think they were able to kind of work through it properly. There is kind of a tabula rasa with the modernists. They don't have a lot of categories about the human nature. And then in postmodernism, there is determinism and behaviorism. So very different points of view. And you could look at all these areas. Another one would be the area of ethics. The pre-moderns, they care a lot about duty and sacrifice, compassion, love. The modernists are more about happiness based upon the pursuit of your, you know, your deepest desires. And then with the postmodernists, you have more existentialism and those kinds of perspectives. If we were to talk about politics, you might say the pre-moderns, you have a hierarchic authority, you have political authorities, you have religious authorities. With modernism, you have individual liberty and equality. And then with postmodernism, you have egalitarianism. You have neo-socialism. You have Marxism. And Joe, let me kind of bring this to a close by kind of looking at some categories in which we can think through, you know, whether you're pre-modern, and that's the Christian perspective, or modern or postmodern, you have differing ideas about the grand narratives. Can you have a worldview? Can you defend a worldview? Can you test them and show that one is better than another? What do you think about the issue of universal truth? What about logic and reasoning? You know, can we ground these particular ideas? And Joe, I think in some ways, you know, we have a world today that it's not completely new, but in some ways it seems pretty new. But I think we have to kind of go back to How do we work through these ideas? How do we think through them? I think back to catechism. I think back to logical categories and analysis. I think being wise and prudent are all very important as we kind of think through these ideas. But I have to tell you, I was watching Bishop Robert Barron. I think his name is Robert, first name. He is a Catholic bishop here in California. He may be an auxiliary bishop, but I think he has a home here in Santa Barbara. Anyway, he took his doctoral degree in philosophy. And so he was kind of giving a presentation, and he was talking about how influential people like Marx, people like Nietzsche, people like Sartre, people like Foucault are to where we are right now. And I have to say, he kind of sparked my way of, hey, how can we kind of frame this? How can we kind of work through this? And I think in many ways, it kind of brings us back that, you know, as different as we might be between Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox, I think one reason for us to build strong relationships with Christians in other communities is that we all have common enemies. We all have issues that strike at the core. And I think it's important to be able to kind of think through these issues. And so I hope these two programs will have done that. Joe, some books. Well, for me, a very important book is going to be A World of Difference, where I look at kind of the worldview issues. But I also think Christianity Cross-Examined is going to play an important role, because in the second part of that book, I look at the question about whether Christianity has been good. And some of the criticisms that are brought to bear against Christianity come from a postmodern standpoint. So I think both of those, I might even suggest the book that I helped Fuzz write, Humans 2.0, that looks at humanism and kind of technology and the movement forward.
Very good. Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. I've learned a lot about the history of philosophy in some ways here. So I appreciate that. I'm sure Dave has as well.
Yes.
There have been people who have been reading your books, Ken, as we mentioned on the last podcast, and here are a couple more letters that have come in, and I'll read them now. Here's one, says, at 56, I'm finally gaining a strong interest in apologetics, as I know God must have more goals for me. I've always known God has a calling on my life, though I haven't fully responded to it yet, maybe besides just passing out tracts and gospels. I would like to read more apologetics books, God Among Sages as well. God bless you, Brother Samples, for your scholarly contributions, Russell Williams. So thank you for that one there, Russell. And here's another one that's come in. Dear Professor Samples, your book, Classic Christian Thinkers, is first in our monthly list of books suggested to our church. The topic, classic Christian literature. Quote, the church is always more than a school, but the church cannot be less than a school. End of quote. Yaroslav Pelikan, as quoted by Ken Samples. I am so fortunate to have studied and continue to through your books, lectures, and podcasts under your tutelage, Jack Mumford, pastor of Rock Christian Church. It's quite a letter there, so I'm sure you're pleased to hear that.
Very much.
Thank you to both of you, Jack and Russell. Keep those notes coming in. Many of you have found ways to reach Ken via social media. Facebook, Twitter is Twitter handle at RTB_KSamples. You can also comment at reflectionsbywordpress.com, where Ken posts an article every other week there. So thank you for that. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast, and you'll see Straight Thinking there. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.